Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to episode 7 of the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of elite mountain biking. Well, episode 7, I can't quite believe we've got this far, but it's thanks to you guys and girls for listening that we keep going. We've had nearly 6,000 downloads of all the episodes so far, and we've had some awesome feedback on our last episode with Tracy Mosley. If you've missed it, then check out the website downtimepodcast.com and catch up. Keep the feedback coming in, leave us iTunes reviews if you've got the time, or come and find us on Instagram, where we're Downtime Podcast, on Facebook, where we're The Downtime Podcast, and on Twitter, where we're Downtime Tweets. Well, what a mountain biking week it's been. First World Cup of the series over in Lourdes, France, and we've seen 29 downhill bikes attack the circuit. They look pretty promising in practice, but a rain-spoiled final meant we don't quite know where it all washes out. Massive congratulations to our second ever guest, Nico Mullally, taking 7th at the race. Fantastic stuff. This week's guest is Jordi Cortez, the head bike suspension tech at Fox. He's the person that looks after the suspension for some of the fastest riders on the circuit. We talk about the suspension basics, testing with the pros and what you can learn from that, feel versus time versus data. He mentions something that he was testing recently that was 3 seconds quicker over 3 minutes. I'd like to speculate that might be a 29er fork. And he also talks about how to set suspension up from scratch. I hope you enjoy the episode. Jordi Cortez, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
So I'm aware that probably all of the riders know you, and maybe not everyone out there knows your name. Can you just give us a bit of background on who you are and what you do, please?
I am the head bike suspension tuner for Fox. I work with most of our sponsored athletes, as far as bicycle athletes, World Cup downhill guys, cross-country guys, and enduro riders.
Awesome. Pretty cool job. How did you get into that?
Luck, really.
And do you have a technical background? Is that where you come from?
No, not a classic technical background. I mean, I grew up with my hands dirty doing whatever I could get a hold of. I've raced motos and bikes, and I worked for Specialized for a while, just running their cross country program.
Okay.
But I had very little suspension knowledge when I started at Fox. Probably just the basics.
Yeah. But just a really practical background. Then you're used to taking things apart and putting them back together again.
At least taking them apart, yeah.
and finding out there's loads of bits left over when you try and put them back together, right?
Making things lighter.
Excellent. So before we go into too much detail, I'm aware that certainly for me on occasion, and for plenty of people, I'm sure if they admit it, some of the terminology in suspension can get a bit confusing. So can you just take us through some of the basics like rebound and compression damping, and the difference between high speed and low speed damping? Maybe talk a bit about preload and ramp rate, just so that everyone's kind of familiar with the terms that we'll probably come back to.
Sure. What do you want to start with? Compression?
Yeah, let's do that.
Compression damping is the resistance of a shock or a fork, and basically the damper, to slow the movement of compression. So you're pushing the shock together, and the compression damping is slowing that force.
So it's changing how quickly the fork moves when it hits a bump, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And rebound is the exact opposite. The spring is trying to push the shock back to extension, mm-hmm. and rebound is trying to slow that down.
Okay. And so how do high and low speed factor into those two elements then?
I think the biggest misconception is that high and low speed are related to your speed.
Right.
And they really don't have anything to do with that. It's strictly how fast the shock or fork is moving. So low speed compression is the beginning circuit, and it's usually just an orifice, a little hole that's adjusted with some type of screw to open and close it. And it affects low speed weight transfer. So if I shift my body weight forward, or if I move back, or that first tap on the brake lever, it's a very subtle feeling.
Okay. And does that
high speed?
Sorry, does the low speed help the bike sit up a little bit more in its travel, or is that not the right way to think about it?
It does in a dynamic situation, which means when you're actually moving.
Okay.
When you're setting your sag up, damping will have no effect on that.
Okay. So there has to be a speed of movement of the shock, right?
Right. The shock has to be extending and compressing.
Okay, cool.
And then low speed damping will either hold it up or let it sit farther in.
Okay. And then high speed?
High speed is when shock speeds or fork speeds start to pick up. So say you're rolling over little speed bumps in the road, something smooth, that's low speed damping. Say you change that to a curb shape, but you don't change your speed, you've activated high-speed damping.
Okay, so that's for the more chattery kind of hits on a trail, is that?
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Really, just as how fast your bit of suspension is moving.
Uh-huh. Okay, and what about ramp rate? Because you hear a lot of people talking about that. What do they mean when they're talking about the ramp rate of a shock or a fork?
Sometimes I don't know what they mean. I don't think they know either. But progression or ramp rate basically means the change in forces that it takes to compress the suspension. So a linear suspension compresses at the same rate from the very beginning of travel to the very end.
Mm-hmm.
Progressive one gets progressively firmer as it goes through. So the more progressivity you have, the harder it is to bottom something out, the more weight it takes to achieve full travel.
Okay. And that's something that I certainly hear a lot of the riders on the World Cup downhill circuit talking about, wanting shocks to be as progressive as possible so that they can take those big hits but still have a supple feel over some of the trail. Is that right?
Yep. Spring curves in general are very tricky, and it's one of the things that is hard for a manufacturer to make a bike to please everyone.
Mm-hmm.
From the average consumer to a World Cup rider.
Okay, so talking about the World Cup riders, then you get away testing with a lot of the teams. Can you talk us through what a test program looks like, kind of how you set up, how you work through the program, and what sort of things you're measuring while you do that?
Ideally, the rider or the team has been on the bike. There's nothing brand new. You don't want to throw in something right off the bat, and you don't want a rider on a brand new bike with no time on it, because then they're learning too many things at once. So generally our test sessions, the riders show up, we spend the morning riding what they're used to riding.
Okay.
Getting the feeling, getting up to speed, learning the track. And then depending on what we're doing, whether it's fork work or shock work, we start doing one thing at a time. And that's something that a lot of people get in over their head, is by making multiple changes at once. And when you start doing that, it's really hard to track exactly what you've done and what's made a difference.
Okay.
So with our test program, we have little bracket sheets, and we do one little change at a time, do a run, do another change, do a run. And it's always balanced against timing.
Mm-hmm.
We've definitely found that just because something feels fast doesn't mean that it is.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So you're measuring time. What else are you measuring? Are you taking specific measurements from the bike, from the forks or the shock?
We do use DataAC, Not in general. That would be the exception. Some people swear by using data. And I think for a brand new product or a new bike, it's very relevant to actually use a data ACC system. You can get some valuable information. But for general testing, the rider's feel and timing is far more important than a data system.
Okay. And do you find that the rider's feel and the timing often correlate? Or do you, like you mentioned earlier, sometimes things can feel fast, but the clock can show otherwise?
You know, it's 50-50. You can easily tune yourself into a slow lap time. And that depends on riders, too. Some riders have a great feel and they know how fast they're going, and some don't.
So how detailed is your timing feedback? I'm assuming it's more than just a beacon at the top and the bottom of the track. Are you breaking it down into segments, or how do you approach that?
We always break into segments just to give people a bit of a break in between. And it's tricky to find a test track that has a consistent top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Time that you want them to focus on. You don't want to do a 5 minute run. Really, a couple minutes is ideal.
Okay.
Yeah. And allowing her to focus on two or three sections really minimizes the chance of accidents and fatigue. Like you get to pin it for one section, settle for a second, go for it again.
Yeah. Okay.
And it lets break it down into little bits. So if you find something that's got a lot of turns, and then you find something that's just fast and straight, and then find something that's rough, you can kind of break down little bits here and there as to what suspension's doing.
And do you like to have a trail, I guess, that has kind of mixed segments in that respect? So obviously some really nice, gnarly, rocky stuff, but maybe some high-speed chatter and things like that, so you can test across different surfaces?
Ideally, yeah. That's what you're looking for. Yeah. It's hard to find.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite test track around the world, or...?
You know, we tested in Lusa, Portugal last year, and other than the weather being horrendous, it was a pretty darn good track. Quick shuttle. I mean, the uplift comes into play too. The quicker that is, the fresher everybody stays, and that one's not so bad.
Interesting. And how, like, you know, how much kind of time can you find through these shock settings and fork settings over a day's testing? Can you give us a feel for maybe over a minute, like how much time you can shave off by optimizing to the degree that you guys do?
It's hard to say. I mean, it depends on where you're starting.
Okay.
You know, if you're coming in mid-season to somebody that's been racing World Cups and you find a consistent half second, that's pretty amazing.
Okay, so it's pretty, yeah, it's pretty fine stuff then.
It's very fine, yeah.
Yeah, but in those early days, like you say, if you've got a new bike or you're new to the suspension brand and maybe you're running some data ACC as well, then you're talking bigger chunks of time, I guess.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, that's kind of the goal. We just did a session here with a couple of different things that are going to be coming out soon. And we were finding 3 seconds on a 3 minute run.
Wow. Okay. So pretty significant.
Big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
and consistent. So if that holds up, then we're going to be doing all right.
Good stuff. So is there ever an occasion where a rider will choose a tune that is perhaps slightly slower from a timing perspective, but they feel more comfortable with?
Yeah, probably consistently, because a lot of that happens at the races.
Right.
You can test and test and test, but it's going to change at the race. There's no way to replicate a race setting, whether it's track or nerves or just whatever it is.
And how far from that base setting that you get set up early in the season will a rider kind of vary from race to race? Does it change quite a lot? Or do they tend to make fairly small adjustments from that standard base setting, unless they're having a horrible season, I guess?
Yeah, that's the one. It's really dependent on the rider. Some riders will pick a setting and not touch it all year. Plus or minus, you know, a click maybe here or there, which maybe isn't ideal, but it works for them. Other riders will change things all over the place.
And do, so just
starting gate, you know, making changes.
Do you think it that's a good thing, or do you think actually the people that are kind of leaving it alone a bit more maybe have a stronger mental position when they're racing? They're less worried about what the suspension's doing.
I think it's somewhere in between. It's always the middle ground that's makes the most sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you don't change anything, you're never going to find those extra seconds in the bike, which are there. If you do all of your work, you're going to be faster than if you pick bits and pieces because of whatever reason. You don't want to do it, you don't think it's important, or you're a little lazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's work, and it definitely takes energy to think about all of this stuff.
Yeah, it's a complicated trade-off, I guess. Every race, there's no perfect solution, and you're trading off one thing for another a lot of the time. So it's a fine balance, I guess.
Absolutely, with everything.
Yeah.
Your diet, your exercise, you know, what you do to have fun, your testing. There's a lot of things that have to line up to make it a good race.
Very true. So when you're at a, you know, World Cup downhill or enduro event, how different are suspension settings across kind of the top male and female riders? And is there a kind of a significant difference between male and female setup as well? Or are they riding kind of fairly similar suspension settings?
I would say the women overall run stiffer setups than the men do.
Okay, interesting.
Relative body weight and speed. And some of that is probably due to just overall body strength, but that's another tricky one. It's hard to understand it all the time. There's also a far smaller pool to pick from.
True.
It's the women.
Yeah.
So you don't get as wide a range.
Mm-hmm. And what about between the top guys in the sport then? Is there a big difference between their settings, or actually people kind of finding their own way to a fairly similar position?
It's pretty close. There's always going to be a few outliers, but I bet if you kicked off two or three people in the top 20, that the rest would be really close.
Okay, so it does kind of narrow down over a weekend. People get towards a fairly similar position on the whole. You know, obviously some people are a little bit left field, but...
Yeah, and part of that is from our point of view, from Fox. I mean, we've compiled data for years, and we know what it's supposed to be. And you have some riders that you can absolutely guarantee are picking the proper setup. And if somebody's way out of that, you try to bring them back in. And if they don't want to, then you let them go. But so there's multiple reasons why setups are closer, partly because good riders tend to gravitate towards the proper setup, and because we're kind of pointing them in that direction also.
Okay, good. So let's talk about the average Joe then, because we've talked about the professionals for a bit. But say I've just, you know, been out, spent a bit of money, I bought myself a nice shiny new bike, and I want to get the suspension set up as well as I can. I've got maybe basic tools, so a ruler or a little bumper on the shock that shows me kind of sag and things like that, and a decent shock pump. What approach would I take to going out and getting that bike set up well so that I can ride it, you know, regularly and get the most out of it? Because I think there's a lot of people that really struggle with that initial setup of a bike.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it is tricky. I mean, there's a lot you can do, and there's not a lot of information out there that shows you a really straightforward way of doing it. The best thing you can do is set your sag. You can't start doing anything unless you know where sag is. And it's not an absolute, but it is an absolute starting place.
And is there a right way to check your sag? Is there and a wrong way?
Yeah, there is. But I'd prefer you just checked it rather than not check it at all.
That's cool. But what's the best technique to check your sag then? Is it to, you know, to try and sit on the bike in a kind of race-ready position, or make sure you've got all your relevant kit on so that your body weight's about right? How do you do that?
Yeah, relative kit is good. You know, camelback or hydration pack with full of water is a lot of weight. So just hopping on in shorts and sneakers isn't going to give you the most accurate setup, but it's a start. But yeah, preferably you'd be in all your riding kit. You hop on the bike and it's a lot easier to do one end at a time. And almost everything has some sort of sag meter or an O-ring, barring coil shock, which is a little harder. You need two people.
Okay.
But yeah, set your sag. And the next step is going to be setting your volume, considering or guessing that it's an air shock, which most shocks are now, or air fork. And that's something I think most people don't do, because it is a little bit trickier.
So how do you go about setting the volume then? What's the best approach to that?
So you start with your sag, take your bike outside, and start giving it some good bounces.
And what are you looking for when you're doing that? Are you trying to bottom the bike out, or?
Yeah, you're doing your best to just bottom it out. And if you do, you know that you're going to need to increase the progression, which usually means adding some sort of volume spacer.
And would you do that one at a time, or would you kind of go up maybe one or two or three or four and see what impact that has? How do you approach that?
It's doing it in big chunks gives you a definite feel of what you've just done. Sometimes when you do things in small steps, it's tricky to actually feel what's going on. So if you go from, just take a fork, for example, and you go from no volume spacers to the maximum, you're going to know right away what those volume spacers do. But you're probably not going to run the maximum.
Okay, so that kind of bracketing approach, going from low to high on something, can help you get a feel for what it does, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what it is bracketing. Is you start with one, and then you go to the extreme, and is that better or worse? And if it's better, then I guess you've already done as much as you can.
True.
But if it's worse, then you split that in half. Is it better or worse? And you keep splitting it that way.
Okay, that's a good tip. Thank you. So you've got sag set, we've got volume set. What's next?
Next thing is, depending on what product you're running, would be your rebound.
Mm-hmm. And why rebound before compression?
Rebound can affect things just the way compression can, because it can either hold your suspension down so that it feels firmer,
mm-hmm.
or it can make it ride too high in the travel so that it actually feels softer.
Okay.
Again, some people are probably going to tell you to do compression first, and that's either way, you're going to be okay.
Okay. And how do you go about setting up your rebound then?
Rebound is tricky to explain. But basically, with a push test, like an average person at home, you're looking to be able to give a good shove on the bars or the seat and have the wheel or have the suspension return without giving you any kind of hop off the ground.
Okay.
And in real world, that's kind of setting it up, maybe doing a curb drop so that you get the least amount of suspension cycling without it feeling dead. So you want it to return quickly, but you don't want it to bounce back up and down.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So is a curb a good thing to use in suspension setup if that's, you know, if that's the best tool you've got? Is it good to kind of drop off a curb and see how that feels?
It's a good start. Yeah. If that's what's there, it'll get you ballpark for sure. You know, if you drop a curb and the bike's going up and down and up and down, you know it's wrong.
Yeah. So you're looking for the bars to kind of come back, or the saddle to come back as quickly as possible, but to not kind of give you any bounce, I suppose. Is that a good way to describe it?
It's a good way. And that's again something that you will pick up after doing it a little bit. And doing the bracketing, like start with the suspension open, then start with it closed, you'll feel an immediate change.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So that's the rebound side of things. Is it a similar approach with the compression side?
It is similar, yeah. Again, this is going to be a bracketing thing. It's going to be much harder to set compression damping in a home situation or by dropping off a curb.
Okay. So it's time to go riding then.
It is time to go riding.
Awesome. So how would you do it out on the trail then? What is it based on feel or?
It is. Yeah. And the best way to do it is to find yourself a short section of trail, something that you get the feel for riding, but you're not getting tired and you can repeat it easily.
Okay.
Even 15, 20 seconds and do the same thing. Bracket your suspension. Start with it open. Start with it. Then switch it to closed. Then switch it to the middle. And you just keep asking yourself, better, worse. You don't have to say, it's skipping here, it's rebounding here, it's kicking me here. You just have to say better, worse.
Okay. So you keep it real simple then, basically. Just bracket and keep going at 50%. And then, better, worse. See how you feel.
Absolutely.
Okay. Interesting.
It gets a lot trickier when you start getting into downhill shocks and shocks with high speed and low speed, especially high and low rebound. Because everything kind of affects, they all have a crossover and they all affect each other in some way.
So can you give an example of a feeling that you might get from a trail that would mean you should either go and do something with your high speed or low speed damping? Is there a way to kind of describe it like that?
Yeah, there is. It's not as simple as, I'm getting kicked. That's a pretty classic one. Somebody says, I'm riding down this and I keep getting kicked. Well, are you getting kicked because the suspension compresses and then is pushing you back, which is a rebound kick? Or are you getting kicked because the suspension is compressed and you don't have any suspension left, and then you're getting kicked because you're smashing into something? Okay. That's also a rebound kick, but it's too slow.
Yeah.
Or are you getting kicked because you hit something and the suspension doesn't move? And that's a compression kick.
Yeah.
So everything can imitate something else.
Okay, so it gets pretty cloudy.
Right. So if you hit something, you go, I'm getting kicked. I bet my compression's too firm and my rebound's too slow. And you adjust all those and it's not better. You still don't know which one to go back to.
Okay. So is that another instance where bracketing can help you out, or would you do something
bracketing.
Different? Yeah.
Definitely bracketing and keeping track of what you just did.
And so it sounds like it's really worth people taking, you know, a good, I don't know, couple of hours with a new bike or a new set of forks or a new rear shock to go and find that piece of trail and actually do that work, right? Because they're going to get a lot more out of their bike long term by putting in those few hours up front.
I think so. I mean, I guess it's what I do for a living, so I would hope that I did it. But, I mean, you spend a lot of money on bikes, and the suspension is a big part of that. So why not make it work?
Cool. Okay. And there's a few kind of new devices starting to come onto the market that are there to try and help people set up the suspension that connect into your smartphone and things like that. Have you had any chance to have a play with any of those, or, you know, how do you feel about them? Do you think they can be helpful?
I think they definitely have their place. It'll probably get you through the basics faster.
They're quite a significant investment, right?
Yeah, they're not cheap. I can't imagine buying one.
Right.
But I think I've already seen quite a few shops are saying they're going to take orders or they're going to start renting them.
Ah, that's a good idea.
I think that's a pretty good idea.
Yeah. So if you were going to rent one, how long do you think you'd need with it? You know, a couple of hours or a day? Like,
I think a day to make yourself comfortable. The thing is, you can't really test for a day. I mean, most people can't. You're going to get tired.
Yes, true. And then you're going to lose feel for what's really going on, I suppose.
Yeah, you need to be motivated and you need to be fresh.
Yeah.
But if you lay out your program and you know where you're going to go and you have everything set, you can easily test in half a day.
Cool. And it should make a pretty big difference, I guess, if you don't really know what you're doing with your suspension and then getting it set up right, either by a qualified person or buy one of these helpful devices, and that's got to be a good thing, I suppose.
I think so, for sure.
Cool. So once you've got it all set up, is there anything specific that you would recommend people do to kind of keep their suspension in the best condition possible? Because, you know, I think service intervals are increasing on forks, but is there anything we can do kind of ride to ride, day to day, to keep them in good shape?
Just, it's really the same as anything else. Just don't spray it with a pressure washer.
Right. Yeah.
Keep it, just wipe it. The best thing you can do is just wipe it down. There's not really anything you can spray on it. You don't want to pour oil on it. I guess there's a few products that they say are for suspension to keep seals pliable and remove moisture. And I don't know. It probably won't hurt, but I don't think you really need to do it. The best thing to do is keep it dry. I think, at least for our products, they have a fair amount of oil in the lowers. So hanging bikes by the front wheel does actually do something because it lets the oil drain back and re-lubricate the foam rings
that
are underneath the wipers.
And if you can't hang your bike, I guess storing it upside down maybe on the bars and the saddle might help.
Funny, it doesn't actually, because it'll pour the oil into the stanchion.
Ah, right. Okay. So it go too far. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So get a bike hook on the wall then.
Yeah. It helps.
Yeah.
It's not an absolute, but it definitely helps a little bit.
Interesting. And if you're sending your forks off for a service, because I think certainly in the UK, I don't know about in the US, but a lot of people, rather than doing the kind of complicated servicing, maybe because they haven't got the right tools or the space to do it, or they don't want fork oil all over the kitchen, they tend to send their forks off to someone. Would you recommend getting in touch with that company and having a proper chat with whoever's going to be working on your forks before you do that?
Yeah, I think that's not a bad idea. Because it helps to have somebody that has an idea of what they're doing. And I guess that's one way to kind of sort that out.
Mm-hmm.
Suspension's tricky. I mean, doing a lower service is very straightforward.
Right. Okay.
So if that's all you're doing, then it's not so big a deal. And more shops are starting to specialize in that. But if you're having anything else than that, or if you want to do some actual tuning, then picking your suspension shop is pretty important.
Cool. Okay. And what sort of things would you want to mention to them? You know, do you want to talk about riding style or, you know, weight, that kind of stuff? What are the key things to tell them if they're going to be working on and potentially tuning your suspension for you?
Weight is a big one. Riding style is tricky because you never know if people are telling the truth or what they're relating it to. You know, you'll get ex-pro guys saying they're slow, and you'll get new amateur riders saying they're pretty fast. So, you know, without knowing somebody, that's hard.
So trying to be realistic with the person that's tuning your suspension, I guess, being honest about your level of skill and ability and the kind of trails that you're riding.
For sure. But then the other thing is, if you weigh 130 pounds, then whoever you're talking to should know that, that something's going to have to be changed in your fork or shock. And again, if you're 250 pounds, something's probably going to need to be changed also.
Okay. Good. Good advice. Well, Jordy, it's been really interesting. We're coming towards the end of our time together today. But before we go, if people want to keep in touch with you and follow what you're up to, where can they find you on social media?
I'm at Cordy Jortez on Instagram, and I'm on Facebook also.
Excellent. Well, thanks for your time today, Jordy. I think there's some really useful stuff in there for people. I've really enjoyed chatting. Best of luck for the season. I hope it goes well.
Thanks so much, Chris. Hope I didn't confuse people.
Good stuff. No, it was great. Thank you very much. Well, that's it for episode 7. I think there's some great stuff in there, and I hope you found it useful. If you haven't listened to our previous 7 episodes, then check them out on our website, downtimepodcast.com. Otherwise, episode 8 will be dropping on the 16th of May, and we'll have another great guest for you then. Until then, get out and ride.